Brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible. Financial geniuses. Monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it. So your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holiday install to get started. Lowe's, we help, you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous U.S. only.
Hey, what is up, everybody?
And welcome back to Mile Higher Podcast, episode 345. I'm your host, Kendall.
I'm Josh.
And today we are joined by, again, 2 weeks in a row, Tom is joining us. Welcome back, Tom. And then, of course, our man, Ian.
Hello, hello, hello.
We always love having Tom on the show, too. It's super fun. Janelle, actually, she was going to be here today, but last minute, her mom's having some big surgery today, and it ended sooner than they had thought, so she had to go pick her up. So she's not joining us, but she does miss all of you guys. She was very bummed to miss last week as well. But yeah, we've got the dream team here today, so we're looking forward to getting into this one, although it is totally insane and also very, very sad.
Probably one of the more disturbing cases.
Very.
And insane in the aspect of, we're dealing with a very evil individual here, Daizen Hassenkopf, which we'll find out later on is probably not his real name.
No, isn't his real name. We know it's not.
But we've got this guy. He is a complete con man, and he's tricking women. He's a womanizer. He's a misogynist. He's just a horrible piece of shit human being.
A liar. A cheater.
In the most insane ways you could think of.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, he goes around convincing people that he's a 400-year-old alien.
Yeah.
But he's a good alien.
Mm-hmm.
He's a good alien.
Alien for good.
But he's going around scamming people with these, you know, live forever serums and injections, just swindling money. He's obsessed with blood. And ultimately, his actions, along with those of a few other absolutely insane individuals,
mm-hmm.
kind of culminates into who the victim in this case is. We're talking about Girly Chu Hassenkopf. She disappears. She fails to show up for work, which is very odd for her. And she completely disappears. And then some evidence is discovered to suggest that she is likely deceased and likely murdered, but her body has still not been found to this day.
Yeah.
And it's crazy. I mean, this is definitely one of the crazier cases.
Yeah, you're in for a wild ride, certainly.
But we're gonna of course start where we usually do. We're gonna start at the very beginning and talking about Girly Chu. Who was she before she became Girly Chu Hassenkopf? And for that, we're going to go all the way back to when she was born.
So Girly Chu was born on August 27th, 1963, and she was raised in Penang, which is Malaysia's island state. Her parents, Chu Shing Kang and Margaret Chin Jiok Wan, gave her a very loving and supportive childhood, and their home was, quote, the center of her universe. According to her brother, Eric Chu, quote, the neighbors are kind, nice, and extremely helpful. They are very concerned for each other. It's like a big family. It does sound very nice. And that sense of love and trust didn't stop in Girly's neighborhood. The crime rate in Malaysia, at least when Girly grew up in the 70s, 60s, that whole time period, was nearly non-existent. Petty crimes came with severe punishments, including the death penalty, and owning a gun was completely illegal. And while this has proved to be a problem for many, for Girly, it instilled a sense of trust in those around her and made her feel completely safe and in ease in the presence of strangers. On top of that, Penang is a very beautiful place to grow up. In the center of the island's 113 square miles were mountains, and the city of Tongjongbunga, close to Gurley's neighborhood, was home to the world's largest butterfly field, which sounds absolutely magical. When Gurley was 21, in January of 1985, she landed her first job as a marketing representative at the Hong Kong Bank in Penang. And the bank was actually originally a post office that was built in 1883, and the building had become really a major tourist attraction. It's very, very beautiful. But more important than the job was Gurley's faith, which she staunchly practiced the rest of her life. She often visited the Chinese Buddhist temple in Penang, the Goddess of Mercy temple in reverence to Kuan Yin, who Gurley always had a bedroom shrine devoted to.
In 1989, Gurley and her coworker, Susan Oh, took a vacation to the United States for the first time. And the pair loved the trip so much that it soon became a yearly vacation for them, picking a different state each time to explore the following 2 years. However, this is where the story becomes somewhat unclear. According to some sources, Gurley first met Daisen Hassenkopf on a vacation to San Diego with Susan, where she met him while at SeaWorld. Other sources state that they first became acquainted through a pen pal magazine and met in person only after they had spoken through letters and emails.
And I also wanted to note, we're not like completely sure that it's pronounced Daisen. That's like our best guess, but
yeah.
There's so many documentaries and interviews where it's pronounced differently. Like, no one seems to know.
Daisen.
And it's also,
Daisen.
As you'll find out, it is a made-up name. So we're not really sure.
We're not sure. We're going with Daisen because that seems to be, at least with the documentaries and interviews that are more contemporary, people are saying Daisen.
Yeah.
However, I definitely, like, in certain news reports, people were saying Daisen.
Yeah, that's what I kept saying, Daisen.
And so it's, yeah, just... it's a name. You can say it however you want. It's
I keep my
up.
Brain wants to say Daisen so bad.
Daisen.
Daisen.
And Daisen, German. Hassenkopf.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fake German.
Mm-hmm. Fake German.
Mm-hmm. Regardless of the truth, on April 20th, 1992, Daisen wrote a letter to Gurley's parents, introducing himself and letting them know their daughter had already accepted his hand in marriage, and their wedding was later on that year. This letter displays Daisen Hassenkopf's many lies, which wouldn't be uncovered until nearly a decade later, which is crazy. This letter begins, quote, "My point of origin is Zurich, Switzerland," before he apologizes to Gurley's father for not getting his blessing before asking her to marry him. My point of origin is Zurich, Switzerland. Mm-hmm. Okay. Which, this will be funnier later on because you'll know this is not his origin at all. Then he wrote, quote, "I work for NASA, which has a National Defense Systems subdivision called NDS. Gurley had also said that he was a nationally revered surgeon who was flown all across the country to work on people who had been in traumatic and damaging car accidents. He ended the letter with, quote, "Fondly yours, Daisen Hassenkopf."
Fondly yours. Okay. So in the months between that April 20th letter and their marriage at the end of the year, Daisen got to work putting together the life that he had promised her in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And that started with a name change dated July 17th, 1992. And although Gurley only knew him as Daisen Hassenkopf up until then, he was legally known as Armand or Armando Chavez. And we will explain more of that later. And on December 28th, 1992, Daisen purchased a $7,500 wedding ring. And the next day, Gurley arrived in Los Angeles, awaiting a connecting flight to Albuquerque, where she would meet and marry her doctor, scientist, government agent, fiancé. And 10 days after Gurley arrived in Albuquerque, she married Daisen Hassenkopf.
In April of 1993, Rosella Ernestine Johnson, referred to as Ernie, hired Gurley at the Bank of New Mexico's branch at Montgomery Boulevard. This would be Gurley's first job before she started working at Bank of America a few years later. And when Gurley got hired, Ernie said, quote, "Here's this little gal who comes from clear across the world. She deserves a chance." Ernie and Gurley were sent to the Renaissance Boulevard branch, known for serving only about 20 customers daily. Previous employees were known for slacking off, killing time on the phone, or just straight up pissing each other off. However, that was not the case with Gurley. According to Ernie, quote, "She was always immaculate. The way she carried herself, always so neatly dressed, her hair, everything was perfection. You could have put an old sack on her and she still would have looked cute. She was just so perfect."
She really is, I mean, beautiful, but also just cute. I think that's a good way to describe her.
Within only a week of meeting, Gurley wanted to learn how to make New Mexican food, and Ernie showed her how to make pozole, green chili, and her favorite, pico de gallo. Gurley told Ernie about how beautiful Malaysia was and how they needed to take a trip there soon. Ernie laughed it off, but told her they should make some trips to places in New Mexico, like Taos, which is on my list of places to visit as well. Looks like a cool spot.
It is really, really, really cool. And you can get some really good hot chocolate. They call it drinking chocolate, but it's really good.
Ooh, I need to try that. That sounds amazing.
It's very, and it's just like that much. Like, it's such a tiny amount, but you sip on it.
I think you've told me about this.
I probably have, because I love chocolate. I'm a big fan.
And you go to New Mexico quite a bit.
I do. Yes, yes, yes. I love New Mexico. Crazy place, though.
Yeah, as we've seen in other episodes as well. But Ernie asked Gurley why her husband didn't want to take her around the state. And Gurley explained that he didn't like to get out much and didn't want to show her around. While Gurley and Dyson would spend many holiday dinners with Ernie and her husband, under the surface, she was starting to doubt the man she had married. While she didn't say these doubts explicitly to Ernie, Gurley began to worry that Dyson wasn't the man that he claimed to be. The most personal part of her marriage that Gurley shared with Ernie was that Dyson wanted children, but Gurley couldn't conceive. Ernie tried to convince her that adoption, you know, is a good option, but Gurley never really pushed it. Gurley and Dyson also got close with her next-door neighbor, Pedro Tirado, who was in his 70s and had retired from being an agronomist for the U.S. government.
And Pedro really liked that Dyson also claimed to be a scientist, and he felt like they would get along since they both had government jobs. They became close with one another in the months leading up to Gurley's arrival from Malaysia. Pedro said of Dyson, he was very well-dressed, impeccably, personality is how he said it. He wanted to give the best impression. And soon, Dyson went to Pedro's house daily to play dominoes, a tradition that they would continue once Gurley Chu and he married. Dyson began telling him strange stories about his past, okay? So according to him, Dyson's first wife and two children died in a horrible car accident. He also shared that he had graduated from the University of Japan when he was 12 years old. Very impressive. He was also working with the government on experimental drugs, and the FBI was monitoring him. So obviously, Pedro is thinking this is one interesting cat here. And when Gurley began seeking medical attention for her infertility, Dyson told Pedro that he was, quote, the last of the Hassenkrofts, except for an uncle back in Germany. However, he told Pedro's wife, Luz, a completely different story. According to her, Dyson was raised in Switzerland, and his father was living in New York with two daughters. And it was due to these conflicting stories that she just stopped trusting Dyson, especially when he kept telling everyone that he was dying of leukemia, which was something that everyone except for Luz believed. And while Gurley attempted to fix her infertility problems, the Hassenkrofts decided to get a pet, a reddish chow puppy. Those are so cute. I love chows. However, it was very sad. Only a few weeks after having this dog, Gurley showed up at Ernie Johnson's house and said, quote, my girl died. Apparently, out of nowhere, the previously healthy puppy just began convulsing and shaking before it died right in front of Gurley. And obviously, this was very, very upsetting for her. And when they got a second puppy, this one wasn't around long either because it randomly disappeared from their backyard. And Dyson broke the news to Gurley, who was heartbroken. Definitely makes you think, since he's the one who's breaking
the
news.
Yeah.
I mean, this is just, I think, all of our opinions, but I think Dyson killed both of those dogs.
He had something to do with it.
Yeah.
Brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy. Just drop in some details about yourself and see if you're eligible to save money when you bundle your home and auto policies. The process only takes minutes and it could mean hundreds more in your pocket. Visit Progressive.com after this episode to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio.
In February of 1996, the couple moved to a new home just around the corner on Moon Street. They still maintain their close relationship with the Tirados. However, Dyson spent even more time out of the house, sometimes more than a week. And his excuse for doing this was that he was being rushed to operating rooms across the country, sometimes working over 16 hours on patients who had been through horrific car accidents. And Gurley, who still harbored her doubts about Dyson, believed he was traveling to these different hospitals because it seemed like they were financially well off. I mean, Dyson purchased her a green BMW and a Jaguar for himself, both in cold hard cash. While their home wasn't nearly as luxurious as the cars, it had all the items and furniture necessary, you know, for a large home. However, there was one room inside of this house that was off limits to everyone, including Gurley. Dyson would spend most of his time at home inside of his secret little room.
That is like the biggest red flag ever. Can you imagine
when
I would take an axe to the door for sure.
Like, what do you got in there?
Yeah.
I mean, you want to come off suspicious and shady?
Yeah.
Have a secret room and a door that's locked all the time.
Who did we cover recently that had a secret room?
Drew Peterson.
Yeah.
His was more like a fucking like a sex dungeon.
Yeah.
Evil.
Yep.
And I mean, Dyson's is no better, but I don't know. Yeah. You can't have a secret room in your house and not be doing something. You can have a man cave that has a sign that says no girls allowed.
Yeah. Okay.
But
I guess you can. But
it ain't going to be up for long unless you live alone.
But to lock people out of it.
Right. That's just like immediately like what you said to Josh. What are you keeping in here?
Yeah.
Like what the fuck is in this?
Yeah. What? That's like to me when you're married to someone, there are no secrets like that, especially in your own home. But she's terrified of him too, which we'll get to. And I wouldn't want to push him if I were in her shoes either. So I get it.
No, this guy's out of his mind. Get this. After 6 months living in the new house, Dyson came home from a trip with a new addition, a 3-week-old baby named Dimitri.
Yes, you heard that right. He just showed up with a baby.
Which Gurley, she immediately called Ernie, who was shocked because Gurley had previously said that she didn't want to adopt a child, right? When Ernie saw the infant, she asked how Dyson got this small boy. Gurley explained that he had adopted Dimitri through his lawyers, although she didn't even know how he had acquired a child on a random trip out of town. Oh, how confusing. What on earth is going on here?
Imagine your spouse coming home with a child.
Yeah.
Like,
goes on a business trip. Comes home with a like,
it's like, look what I picked you up on the way home.
A young kid.
And it's really sad. I mean, this poor kid.
Yeah.
We'll explain more. It's horrible.
Later on, Dyson would also explain that he had harvested eggs from Gurley before giving them to a surrogate mother. What?
Yeah, he had done
so
a
he just went off and did
own.
This and then did it. Yeah.
And she has no idea that it happened. Okay.
Yeah. And as you can imagine, you know, if we were somehow involved in this situation, Ernie, the neighbor, is like, okay, so this is not adding up. At this point, Ernie found it hard to believe all of Dyson's crazy stories. For one, when they first met in 1993, he explained that his various trips out of town were for grad school. Then he said he was a touring lecturer before finally settling on, oh, I'm a traveling surgeon now.
Yeah.
Because that's exactly how it works, right? And his stories for others, like Pedro Torrado, were getting even more intense. In 1990, the U.S. Department of Energy teamed up with the NHS to try to identify all 30,000 parts of the human genome. Because the project was daunting, the government funded the program until 2005 to complete it. Around 1995, Dyson Hassenkopf claimed he had done it himself.
Because he's a genius.
He told Pedro that he had a machine broken up into 5 parts that when he combined them, it could map the human genome. I'm sure it's that simple. I'm sure it's
just 5 pieces.
Connect these 5 parts and boom.
It's giving like, what's her name? Elizabeth Holmes. Is that her name?
Yes. Yeah. Theranos.
Yeah.
Style. Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Did you see that her husband is trying to raise money now too?
Yes.
For
he's
like
starting
a
his
blood
own
identification program or
yes,
something like that.
That he's, yeah, I just saw a headline for it. I didn't really look into it, but yeah, he's trying to create his own company that has to do with.
As his wife is in jail.
Yeah. She's still in jail. He's like, round two, baby.
Wow.
I don't want to be left out. Maybe I can go to jail too.
Well, anyways, Dyson told Pedro that the project would be worth billions of dollars once all 5 were put together at the University of New Mexico. He urged Pedro to invest. Come on, man. It's going to change the world. And he was convincing enough that Pedro began taking money out of his savings and giving it to Dyson. So Dyson's got some level of
personality.
Personality.
As you
put it. You know?
He's got like, he's persuasive. He's and very convincing.
He sounds like he knows a lot of big, you know, he name drops. He's like one of those name dropping.
I think he like probably just would talk over people's heads too and just say a bunch of things that sound smart to get people to get on board.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, I was telling you guys before this, but in the book, September Sacrifice, which is written about the Gurley Chew case by Mark Horner, who was an investigative journalist who was covering it at the time. He said specifically that Dyson would know within like a minute of meeting someone whether or not he could scam them. And if he felt like he couldn't scam them, he would just stop interacting with them. And that's why he didn't really interact with Pedro's wife that much, Luz, but he was like, Pedro, I got on the hook. So he definitely knew. It might not be that he was so good at convincing people. I mean, he certainly was to a certain degree, yeah. But it was more so that he knew who would be, who he could prey upon, really.
The type of people that he could trick.
Right.
Yeah.
Soon, Dyson would start taking Dimitri over to the Verados while Gurley was at work, so Luz could care for the child while Dyson scammed her husband, essentially. When Luz told Dyson she couldn't raise his son, he took Dimitri across the street to another woman's house, and whenever he would pick him up, Dimitri would scream, quote, I don't want to go. I like it here. Says pretty much everything you need to know.
Yeah. Yeah.
A person that should not have a child.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Furthest from the type of person who should have a child. So in the summer of 1996, Kimberly Glasgow, which is actually not her real name, was working a regular shift at Supercuts when a, quote, interesting man sat in her chair. And I bet you can imagine who this interesting man was. It was Dyson. And Kimberly thought that he was funny, he's a doctor, and most importantly, he's single. And he returned 3 weeks in a row before they had their first date. Lots of haircuts. But soon the two of them were going out regularly, and they visited some of the best restaurants in Albuquerque. However, Kimberly noticed that her new boyfriend would sometimes inject himself with a needle up to, not just sometimes, up to 3 times a day. And when Kimberly asked what it was, Dyson explained that it was morphine used to ease the pain of the leukemia that was slowly taking his life. But it wasn't just the leukemia injections that were part of his strangeness. This is where it gets also just warning, really creepy. Her 14-year-old daughter needed a physical to compete in high school sports. And so, of course, Dyson Hossinghoft, doctor, agreed. However, he didn't examine her with his hands or any medical instruments. He simply just had her take off her clothes and he looked at her. So you can just add pedophile to the list as well. And things only got weirder from here because months into their relationship, Kimberly returned home from a late night shift to learn from her 2 sons, who were only 10 and 12 years old, that Dyson had been over earlier to draw blood from them. And obviously she's like, what the fuck? Why are you taking blood from my children? And so she confronted him, and Dyson explained that he desperately needed a bone marrow transfusion for his leukemia, and so he drew their blood to see if they could be a match. Yeah, totally normal behavior.
Which I'm sure that went over real well.
Yeah, I'd be like, fuck
what?
You, I'm calling the police.
You fucking psycho.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Yeah.
Well, and
you don't have my consent to do that, and my children certainly can't consent to that.
No.
The well, hell?
Like, and I think this is just the earliest pattern we can see of Dyson using his leukemia to excuse every bizarre action. I mean, it goes on and on and on about him doing something weird as fuck and then being like, oh, I have leukemia.
Yeah, and I'm dying, so I'm like dying. Had to.
Right, right.
Okay. But yeah, things continued to get weirder from there. So once Dyson asked her, would you kill for me? To which Kimberly said, no. And she asked Dyson if he killed her, how he would get rid of her body. Which is, in my opinion, a really bizarre
question. This is just a weird conversation.
Yeah,
it's
weird.
Their whole relationship is very strange. So Dyson explained that he would pour acid over her until she, quote, disappeared. And that's something to keep in mind, I guess. So then in 1998, nearly a year after Kimberly started dating Dyson, a woman entered her Supercuts, and Kimberly said, quote, she was real concerned and she looked scared and she was talking real fast. Now, the woman said her name was Gurley and that she was married to Dyson. And it's unclear how Gurley found out about the affair, but what is clear is she was terrified more than angry or upset about the affair. She was just scared. And she told Kimberly that he would kill her if he found out that they had met. And that night, Kimberly confronted Dyson and asked him if he was married. And when he still said no, she ended the relationship. And then he said, quote, "So how did you find out that I'm married?" And at first, Kimberly refused to answer the question, but eventually he kept pressing the issue and she said that someone had called her on the phone. And Dyson only said, quote, "I have a feeling I know who it was."
At 5:30 p.m. on January 17th, 1998, Dyson attacked Gurley. He had been drinking and held her in a headlock before their tenant, 53-year-old Shelley Abrams, walked into the kitchen. Dyson carried Gurley to their bedroom before he knocked their dresser onto her. Shelley called Pedro, who immediately rushed over to the house. But Pedro, who is now 75 years of age and frail, bad asset, he got involved in this. He got in between Dyson and Gurley and instructed her to run to his house. According to Pedro, Dyson didn't attack him because, quote, "I was a scientist." When police arrived, Dyson was immediately charged with domestic violence and aggravated battery, but all charges would be dropped in May 1999. It's important to note that Gurley didn't leave Dyson immediately after this incident because she still feared him and cared for Dimitri's well-being. She was also almost certain that he would kill her if she left, and then there would be no one to protect Dimitri, whom she had grown to love as any mother would. So she stayed with Dyson for another year until January 1999, and then she discovered that he had left the door to a secret little room unlocked, and it was here that Gurley Chu finally learned about the man she had actually married.
Brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy. Just drop in some details about yourself and see if you're eligible to save money when you bundle your home and auto policies. The process only takes minutes and it could mean hundreds more in your pocket. Visit Progressive.com after this episode to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio.
She found out that Dyson Hasenkopf was born Armando Chavez Jr., and he was born on March 5th, 1965 in Houston, Texas, and raised by Yolanda and Armando Chavez Sr. Before he was 10, his parents split, and Armando went to live with his father's new family in Phoenix, Arizona. And while the move was tough for him as a young kid, family photos show him happy with half-siblings, and by all accounts, as far as we know, he had a pretty good childhood. At the age of 16, he dropped the O at the end of his name and began just going by Armand. And around the same time, he moved out of his home randomly and lost contact with his birth family. And while his half-siblings had no idea who Armand turned into, they suspected that a serious head injury that he got while playing high school football contributed to this major shift in personality, which could certainly be the case. And there were his grades, too. While Dyson had told everyone that he graduated from the University of Tokyo at the age of 12, and lectured all across the country, his high school guidance counselor described him as, quote, "average across the board," which I'm sure he would just love that description. So then at the age of 21, Armand Chavez married 23-year-old Rosemary Guerrero at the Assemblies of God Church in Gilroy, California. And on his marriage certificate, which Gurley held in her hands, he stated that he was a technician for an immunology lab. And while he did have a part-time job at the San Mateo Hospital, he was still in college. Rosemary would later say that Armand was, quote, "not very intelligent." And although the marriage was pretty normal at first, Armand grew depressed as more and more of his med school applications were rejected. Aw, boo. And in the late 1980s, Rosemary found him in the bathtub drawing his own blood. So the blood obsession started very early on. Armand and Rosemary divorced after only 3 years when she learned that he had been unfaithful. Big shocker. And he contacted her in 1992 and urged her to take out a large life insurance policy in his name. And coincidentally, this is right before he married Gurley.
Gurley also learned that he was later kicked out of the University of Utah for falsifying lab results, faking a letter of recommendation, falsifying a federal grant, and scamming money out of at least two women.
Longtime con man we have here.
Yeah.
She also found his name change application and that he had basically just made up the name Dyson or Diazien, whatever you want to call him, Hassenkopf, because it sounded like a mixture of German and Japanese. Gurley also discovered how he'd been making money for all these years. She saw numerous checks written by a woman called Sunny Blake, which is also not her real name. But Sunny was in her 70s and was in a non-monogamous marriage. In 1993, she put out an ad in the Albuquerque Journal stating that she had breast cancer and was seeking a young lover. Then came along Dyson Hassenkopf, a young doctor who claimed that he had created a serum that could not only reverse her aging, but eradicate her breast cancer. Soon, Dyson was charging Sunny nearly $25,000 a month for his bullshit bogus treatment, which was just vitamin B12 shots. She even purchased a second house he had moved in with Gurley. Crazy. When Sonny's son learned of this, he took out a restraining order against Dyson before Sunny died on January 27th, 1996 from complications related to her breast cancer. I mean, it's just pure evil.
It's so
to
sad.
Scam somebody, period. But to scam somebody who's dying of breast cancer.
Yeah, who's just vulnerable and desperate for help, and he's going to lie. And it's just B12, $25,000 a month. It's just
and was clearly
absurd.
Looking for like a genuine, loving relationship,
mm-hmm.
you know, not
the time
a scammer to come and
ugh.
Steal money.
Dude, he...
It's demented.
I know.
Meanwhile, he also is still telling everyone else in his life that he has leukemia.
Yeah.
Like, he's killing a woman with cancer while he's telling everyone else, like,
I've got it as well. That's why I need all this blood.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
So then, Gurley learned the truth about her son, Dimitri. So in 1995, Dyson was paid by another wealthy mistress to fly to the Banff Springs Hotel in Canada's Bow Valley. A 28-year-old Japanese woman was working at the hotel's jewelry store when Dyson walked on in, and he claimed to be this successful physician who traveled the world with elderly patients on vacation. And for a few months, Dyson would send this woman dozens of postcards from all across the country, and eventually he asked her to visit him at his home in Albuquerque. And in 1995, this woman traveled to stay with Dyson, and they went to his home only briefly while Gurley was at work. Of course. And he told the woman that they should rent a hotel because workers would be in and out of his house. So they can't stay there. Let's go to a hotel. And for the next 3 days, the two became romantically involved. He went to visit her in Canada 3 more times. And on the final visit, he brought along a man named Dwayne Baker, who had been impressed by Dyson's wealth. And he ends up somehow becoming sort of a bodyguard to Dyson, which is wild. And he told Dwayne that the goal of this trip was to get the woman pregnant. And when the woman returned to Japan in 1995, she learned that she was pregnant, and she immediately informed Dyson, and he responded with numerous letters and phone calls over the next several months. And it was through these correspondences that Dyson lied once again, and he told her that this child was going to inherit a rare genetic disorder and that he would have to be the sole parent. So then on August 8th, 1996, the woman gave birth to her son at a hospital in Japan, and she immediately got the baby a passport before she traveled to Juarez, where Dyson met with them and the baby when the baby was only 25 days old. And for 3 days, they spoke together in Juarez before the woman finally gave up the baby, fearing his medical condition. She felt ashamed, and she never returned to Japan, and actually her current whereabouts are unknown to this day. I hope she's doing well, because that is very, very traumatic. And meanwhile, Dyson crossed the border and returned to Albuquerque, where he told Gurley that they had adopted a baby boy named Dimitri.
This is all so bizarre. I don't think I've ever heard of something like this happening.
I mean, we cover all sorts of bizarre stuff, but not this exactly.
Not in this way, yeah.
Yeah.
Also, while Gurley was going through these documents hidden in Dyson's secret room, Dyson caught her. She tried to explain that he had simply left the door unlocked, and she was looking around, careful not to say that she had learned the actual truth about him. Dyson reminded her to never enter his office again, and then lock the door. Which, why did he leave the door unlocked if he's got his whole,
idiot.
All of his crimes and
yeah.
real, you know, real history in there?
Also, like, why keep documentation
why keep
of any
all?
Of this?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Or you'd think he'd have like an alarm, you know, he'd have like a camera, motion camera in there or something that would.
He would now.
Yeah.
I'm yeah, sure he definitely would now.
Yeah. A while ago.
On the evening of January 24th, 1999, Dyson and Gurley were in bed watching TV. Gurley thought things had returned to normal, and she was hoping for another opportunity to bring the various documents to a divorce lawyer. But then things took an odd turn. Dyson asked Grilly to drive to the restaurant in the Hyatt Hotel the next day to pick up a menu for him. He specifically told her to take the highway. Eventually, Grilly said yes, and then Dyson got up and said he was going to go grab a glass of juice. Then moments later, an alarm from inside their garage sounded, and Grilly got up to investigate. When she entered the garage, she saw Dyson, you know, squatting next to her BMW's right rear tire, and it looked like he was trying to loosen the lug nuts.
Most definitely was, in my opinion.
She asked him if he was trying to kill her, just straight up. And then for the second time, Dyson attacked her. While he had her pinned to the hood of the car, she was able to reach inside and press the button on her garage door opener. She was then able to flee from Dyson and ran to the Toronto's home again, where they called the police. Once inside their home, Dyson knocked on the door and pushed Pedro against the wall. Luz blocked his way while Grilly hid somewhere in the house. Dyson threw several of her dresses on the floor and then left. The police arrived and helped Grilly collect her essential documents from their home. They found her box of immigration and health records in the backyard, and Dyson tried to stop them from taking her jewelry box. The next day, Grilly filed for a divorce. The documents in Dyson's secret room were held in a safety deposit box at Western Bank, which Dyson wanted to be kept from the divorce proceedings. Grilly then moved into an apartment complex only a mile from Dyson's house, but kept the location hidden from everyone, including her best friend, Ernie Johnson. The only person who knew was a coworker at the Bank of America who had helped her move in.
She also received a restraining order against Dyson, and she tried to see Dimitri, who she really had developed a close bond with, and he was also very, very bonded with her, connected with her. But every phone call with her soon-to-be ex-husband only ended in terrifying threats. So she signed papers on March 27th, 1999, ending her rights to see Dimitri. And this was heartbreaking for her. And she was also ordered to pay child support, which was only $100 a month due to her very modest earnings of $19,000 a year. And still, that wasn't enough for Dyson. He violated the restraining order 3 times over the next year. He shattered her car windshield while it was parked at Bank of America, called the location numerous times, and once stopped her on her way home from work, yelling at her that he was going to kill her and that she was never going to be found. A trial was set for July of 1999, although it would be pushed back numerous times following appeals from Dyson's divorce lawyer. And what about Dyson? Well, bet you could have guessed this, but he just kept on scamming. On August 29th, 1998, while he was still with Grilly, he reached out to a 50-year-old woman named Julie McGuire, who he had met online through an online dating service. Now, Julie owned a hotel in Aztec, about 3 hours away from Albuquerque. And soon after their first correspondence, he visited with Dimitri, who met her children at the hotel. And while eating dinner at the hotel, Dyson suggested that he and Julie leave to gamble in southern Colorado. So Julie's kids said that they would watch Dimitri, and the two adults left on a short trip. And we're not sure of their exact age, but they were like teenagers.
Yeah. I believe according to the book, at least, they were around like early middle school. I mean, early high school, late middle school. So they're teenagers at this point.
Still, like, in my opinion, pretty young to just leave your kids so you can go off and gamble.
I will say in Julie's defense, I mean,
you
shouldn't go off, leave your kids to gamble, especially you're like barely year old, not even year old son. But this is like the country. Like, Aztec is very rural. I think to them, they're like, well, they're not going to do anything. They're just going to stay in the hotel. Like, nothing really.
I guess so. Anyway, in the car, Dyson began to talk about very strange things. And while he had previously told her that he had earned a biochemistry degree from the University of Tokyo, of course, when he was 12, he now had more information about his past.
And this is when he revealed to Julie that he was half alien and that good and bad aliens had chosen different humans. He told her that she had been chosen by the good ones. Man, to be a fly on the wall.
I was just
going
to say that I would love to see her immediate reaction to this.
She then asked how old he was, and he said he was nearly 400 years old and kept alive by these youth serum shots. He told Julie that he typically charged $32,000 per injection, but he would only charge her, you know, just a little discount, bringing that price down to $3,200 for numerous injections over 6 years.
He's like, I'll take a 10 off of that.
Which I can't help but think this is like to gain favor with her in the relationship. Well, mm-hmm. I'll give you like 100% discount, 80% discount here.
Well, I mean, he probably also thought there's no way I'm going to get her to pay $32,000. So yeah. I'll say it's worth this much.
Lower it from there.
Brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy. Just drop in some details about yourself and see if you're eligible to save money when you bundle your home and auto policies. The process only takes minutes and it could mean hundreds more in your pocket. Visit Progressive.com after this episode to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it, your neighbors know it. Heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
Yep.
Probably that was probably his like target was like, if I get $3,200, that could pay for everything I need.
And were these monthly injections he was trying to sell her?
It's unclear. It was just, according again to the book, it was just multiple over 6 years. So there was a guarantee that
you get multiple.
Yeah.
You get a couple.
You have to stay on the regimen if you start these youth serum shots.
Okay.
To live to be 400 like myself.
Right. And that was with the woman, Sunny, not her real name, but like that was the deal he had with her. With her, it was over $20,000 a month, but it was like once a month, I give you these shots, you give me the money, and you're going to live forever.
Yeah. Okay.
The first trip lasted 3 days, and by the end of it, Julie decided she wanted to give the serums a shot. He returned in October and told her that he needed to draw her blood before administering this serum.
Of course he wanted her blood.
Yep. However, after those two initial trips, Julie stopped hearing from the alien doctor. He reached back out to her in January of 1999. While in reality, he was dealing with a divorce. He told Julie a much more fantastical story. When he came back to Aztec, he told her that the NSA, whoa, different agency, not NASA. Now the NSA is on his ass. They had learned that he was giving her the youth serum shots and that they were out to kill him and Dimitri. What on earth? Then he told her that he had a level 22 government clearance. Okay, sure, bro. And that Dimitri was one of 12 genetically engineered children that the NSA was also seeking to destroy. And what was the name of the genetic project? Project Girly. Through follow-up visits, Julie began to learn that Dyson was genuinely fucking crazy. How could you not? I mean, that this, what?
She's like, this is all.
You're like, what?
I think in the one interview she said, he's as crazy as a bed bug.
Yeah, she did. I like that one.
Crazy as a bed bug. I've never heard that before. I need to start using that.
On another occasion, Julie was at his home in his office and she was sitting on his lap while he messaged another woman on a dating site. He assumed that because Julie wasn't wearing her glasses that she couldn't see. However, she could tell that he was not only messaging another woman, but he was telling her about the youth serum for the low, low price of $3,200 a pop.
Same rate.
She wanted to leave him, but feared for Dimitri's safety. She had come to find out that he was physically abusing the boy and that he had drawn blood numerous times from between his toes. After Dyson's divorce attorney tried and failed to adopt Dimitri, he eventually went to a foster home. On Julie's last visit to Dyson's home, he was being cared for by a woman who called him D and claimed to be his live-in leukemia nurse. But this live-in leukemia nurse was none other than a woman named Linda Henning. And, man.
Linda.
Linda's another nut job.
Yeah.
Not a nurse.
Just going back for a moment, too, I can't believe he was dumb enough to have her sitting on his lap thinking that because she's not wearing glasses, she can't
see.
She's
blind?
Like, yeah. The nerve, the ball.
Ah, she's blind.
It's like that. It's like when you obviously go on a date with somebody and they're like, clearly probably texting somebody else. You always put your phone like face down on the table, but then you're checking it every time they go to use the bathroom kind of thing. You know?
Yeah. Definitely
putting your phone on do not disturb.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Just like hiding all the apps. And
yeah, I'm not on Hinge. But no, it's like it is so crazy to me that not only did he do this in the previously secret room, but he's, you know, like messaging so, like the exact same thing he said to her about the youth serum shots.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's he has a playbook. He's like, well, if she follows me down this lie rabbit hole, I can take her here and here and here and then get to the $3,200. But if she follows me down these ones, I can get her to the $23,000 ones.
Mm-hmm. He like, and how many people do we not even know of that he
we
was,
have
you
know? No idea. There's like, again, just about any time he went out of town, it was because another wealthy woman somewhere in North America, including Canada, was paying for these shots.
Or he was going to try and convince them.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And God, I wonder if he felt comfortable bringing her into the secret room because she wasn't wearing her glasses.
I think that's part of it. I also think at this point, you know, this is post Gurley discovering everything. He had taken most of the sensitive information and put it away at the safety deposit box. So
it's
not as like salacious. It's not as like
he doesn't have his real identity card sitting on the, the fucking desk. Yeah.
So anyway, back to Linda. So Linda Henning was born in Hollywood on October 10th, 1953, and she grew up in San Fernando. And her mother said, quote, "If a boyfriend told her the moon was made of green cheese, she would believe it." And in 1995, Linda met a wealthy investment banker named Steve Zachary, and she tried to get him to invest in her lingerie company. And Steve was immediately smitten with Linda. He's like, ooh, lingerie company. And the two of them entered into a many years long relationship. And even after the two of them broke up, they remained in close contact, and Steve would send her thousands of dollars a month. And he always described her as, quote, the love of my life. Now, they continued to communicate constantly, even as Linda moved to New Mexico and became engaged to a coworker at a payroll company called 21st Century Resources. However, for Steve, things had gotten worse. He had advanced multiple sclerosis and moved to the East Coast to be closer to family. He and Linda did keep in contact. However, throughout early 1999, he noticed communication with her was way less constant. Her company had started working with a health club in Albuquerque, and Linda was given a desk inside of the club to work out of. And one day, while she was speaking with the owner, she let it slip that, quote, the end times were coming.
No big deal.
I love when you just drop something like that at work. To which he responded, quote, you sound a lot like that guy who comes in here, as he's motioning over to Dyson. And according to the owner, Linda's face lit up. Dyson had been attending the health club based on his phony leukemia, attempting to find someone to pay for a $90,000 treatment, because of course he was. And he had been scamming money from a woman who he had met through a dating site who lived in South Carolina, but it was much less than what he was making only a year earlier.
And feeling sorry for Dyson, Linda convinced her friend Bill Miller to take care of him with her at Dyson's home. When they were there, Bill noticed that Dimitri wouldn't eat and would kiss pictures of Gurley, which immediately upset Dyson. Soon they convinced Dyson to accompany them to their UFO club, where David Icke was about to speak, which, you know, if you've listened to the show, we've mentioned him from time to time. Extremely controversial individual, has said a lot of fucking wild things over the years. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He is a whack job, in my opinion.
Yeah. So you can, if you know anything about him, you know what he's about, you know, going to be speaking on.
Yeah. You know his vibe.
Yeah. The other members of the UFO club treated Dyson and by extension, Linda and Bill as clowns. While they all believed in various alien conspiracies, Dyson was the only person who said, guys, I'm half alien. What are we doing? Why are we talking about this? I am a half an alien.
They're like, listen, we love crazy shit, but that is too far for us. You've crossed the line, my dude.
Which, you know, David Icke's there, they're listening to him talk about reptilian world leaders and the whole mm-hmm. reptilian conspiracy. When Linda asked Dyson if this was true, and he said, oh, Linda, it's much worse, which that's scary, too, to think about. Well, if you know anything about the reptilians, they're very evil extraterrestrials, and they're engaged.
Believed to be.
Yeah.
Curious.
Oh, you believe in them?
No, I'm just kidding.
I'm not, like, completely out on it, but.
They are supposedly evil aliens that maybe exist, and they are engaged in a war on Earth with the good aliens, according to Dyson. So he's like, they're here doing battle with me.
Yeah, of course. One of
and
the
all
aliens.
The other good aliens. Mm. And Dyson told Linda that the good aliens had designated her as a warrior queen who is supposed to kill the evil alien queen, his ex-wife, Girly Chu. After months of not hearing from one of his best friends, Steve Zachary got a call from Linda in early August 1999, and he learned that she had left her fiancé and was caring for a man named Dyson Hossenkoft. What a fucking stupid name.
I know, it's so stupid.
It's so stupid that it's just fucking made up.
Yeah.
Like, it comes from nothing. He just was sitting around saying shit. He was like, Dyson sounds kind of Japanese, and Hossenkoff sounds kind of German.
That's exactly it. How it happened. I wonder if he would, like, how would he actually pronounce it? Or, like, how did he start pronouncing
Dyson.
It? I wonder if it's just Dyson.
No, I feel like he'd pull one of those, like, it's too advanced in my own language and, like, you can't understand it. This is how humans interpret it.
Dude, what's so totally fucked up is he has, on his business cards, he has a symbol that is basically a swastika, but it's a D that turns into a swastika that he used on all of his business cards, and it was exactly what you just said. Like, that's, in my alien language, that is how my name is spelled.
The D with the swastika? Is how he spells it?
Yeah. And it shows up on, like, every fucking... It was on, like, the letters to Girly's parents. It's...
Oh, my God. This dude.
Yeah, that weird little symbol right there. That's what he would say. That's how he said it would be.
Zoom in.
Interesting.
Hossenkoft Industries Incorporated.
Answers to the future realized today.
Zymogenic at AOL.com. Zymogenic was... Dude, that was his... that was... He used that. That was his profile name on the dating sites as well. Zymogenic, which again means absolutely nothing.
No.
So that's not funny at all.
It sounds cool though.
Yeah. You see how he's got MD, PhD on there too?
Tom, you should try to email.
I will. Zymogenic. I'll reach out to him. I'll reach out to him on my personal one. I'll be like, hey.
What's up?
Hey, what's up? I heard you got some serums.
Yeah.
I want to live forever.
I'm willing to pay the $32,000 as well. Full price.
Yeah.
And I'll just CC you and be like, hey, you brought me $32,000.
Well, I don't think it will make it to him, unless he's got a phone in prison.
I don't know. They give inmates email access sometimes.
Mm. Oh, I'm giving stuff away.
Have you ever... Yeah, I'll cut that part out. But have you ever seen... I might be talking out of my ass, and maybe I'm just ousting myself for what my algorithm pushes to me. But have you guys ever seen how there's, like, you know, correspondence for, like, hot female, like, inmates that people that just propose to, like, trying to get them out of prison?
No. But I want to.
It's a whole thing. And, like, apparently it was, like... I don't know. It was, like, a whole, like... social program of, like, trying to, like, you know, reintegrate people into, like, society,
right?
Like, but it just turned into people who were just like, there's hot women in prison and this seems like an easy way to get laid, and so they would just propose to them and send them, like, fan mail and stuff. It's bizarre.
Doesn't surprise me.
I was gonna say that's right on brand. I've heard of stuff like that for men in prison, but yeah. Interesting women, huh?
There's, like, just pages on Instagram just dedicated to, like, look at this mugshot, and then just the comments just...
Oh, dude, you gotta send that to me. I need to check that out. Wow, what a weird one.
Linda ended up telling Steve that Dyson had created a serum that could not only make him younger, but could also heal him of his brain tumor and MS. My God. So she's getting involved. She's like, let me help. Linda herself had already taken numerous injections of the serum, and Dyson had vials of her blood stored in his home. Steve, always to the point, told her he was scamming her and asked to see his resume. So Linda faxed it over to Steve, and then Steve faxed it to some of his friends who had spent years in academia. And they all told him, this guy's a fucking fraud. I mean, take one look at his business card and you're like, this guy's not who he claims to be.
No.
When he told Linda, she, quote, went berserk and used language that I have never heard from her. All of a sudden, I had a torrential flow of faxes coming my way, warning me that the end of the world was coming. Stuff about cryogenic containers, reptilians, and robots attacking. Now worried for Linda, Steve hired a private investigator to follow her and Dyson to figure out who this guy really was. On August 27th, 1999, Girly's birthday, Linda, Bill, and Dyson took Dimitri fishing before handing him off to his adoptive family. The social worker assigned to the case, Vonda Cheshire, went to his home to transport Dimitri and noticed a revolver out in the open. She asked if Dyson planned to kill himself, as he was acting really upset about giving up his child. After the encounter, Vonda called 911, which forced Police Sergeant Ade to check on Dyson. He forced Dyson to give all of his weapons to a neighbor before he asked, quote, by the way, where's your wife? Dyson responded, quote, she's dead.
Meanwhile, on her birthday, Girly was at the FBI headquarters in Albuquerque because of Vonda's call to 911. They were investigating whether Dimitri was kidnapped as an infant. And Girly then completely revealed everything to them about Daisen, his infidelity, his lies, and that she was worried that he was going to kill her. And later, while out to dinner, Vonda began telling her husband how strange Daisen was and how she was worried for his ex-wife. Then she heard someone say, quote, "You shouldn't tell such stories." It was Daisen sitting in a booth with Linda Henning. They just happened to be there, right?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Can we just talk about how much of a fucking like movie this whole story is?
I know, right?
Where it's like there's the secret room. Then he's like goes to prison and she goes and investigates it. And then he happens to come back home and like catches her at the right time.
Yep.
It's like a jump scare moment.
I know.
And then we have like the secret agent cool shit where he's like, you shouldn't say things like that. He's sitting in the booth next to them.
Mm-hmm. Right? Like yeah. It just happens. It really does play out like a movie. But obviously he's like stalking them.
Yeah.
And listening to their conversation. He's such a creepy fuck. But then in the days after, Linda Henning came into Gurley's Bank of America branch and spoke with her about opening an account. On September 8th, 1999, Gurley contacted the agent at the FBI that she previously had spoken with. Nothing more had happened since they last spoke, but she just had this uneasy feeling that Daisen was going to kill her. And then on September 9th, 1999, Daisen enters this specialty store called World of Knives. And of all the things in there, he ends up purchasing a ninja sword.
Which leads us to September 10th, 8 a.m., Kathy Szymanski, vice president at Gurley's Bank of America location, walked into the branch to start the day. However, a representative named Terry Gruen stopped her on the way in. She said a man had called them and asked if they had seen Gurley. Then a few minutes later, the man called back. It was the husband of Ernie Johnson who told Kathy that Gurley did not answer the phone the night before, and it was the first time since she left Daisen that she hadn't answered. Kathy immediately called the police. Jesse Grove, Gurley's coworker, helped her move, and the only person who knew where she lived drove to her apartment. However, it seemed as though the police didn't take the call seriously at first and didn't advise officers to check Gurley's apartment until Kathy made the fourth call to 911. Jesse, when he got to the apartment complex, entered Gurley's unit with the property manager who hadn't reported hearing strange noises from the previous night. And Gurley's apartment looked pretty normal too. The bed was made and her private shrine to Kuan Yin was undisturbed. They only noticed three bleach stains on her carpeted living room floor. The largest was the size of a basketball and the smallest was the size of a grapefruit. Then at 9:45 a.m., Officer Portwine pulled into the apartment complex when dispatch told him to cancel. Luckily, this officer decided to check the apartment anyhow, just, you know, to be safe. And he went into the apartment and he also observed the bleach stains, but more importantly, he noticed tiny blood stains on the carpet near the couch. Then at 10:23, Sergeant Ade was again dispatched to Dyson's home. He arrived to find out that he had completely moved out and packed up a moving truck the previous Wednesday. The neighbors who took the weapons had returned them since he was said to, you know, he told them, I'm moving out of town, so I need those. I'm going to take those with me. However, other neighbors told Sergeant Ade that a gold Honda Accord swerved into Daisen's driveway in the middle of the night and out walked Daisen in black face paint and all black clothes, and the car matched that of another person of interest, none other than Linda Henning. Then at 10:30, state highway worker Raymond Gabaldon discovered a gray-colored blanket on the side of the road, and he was over 120 miles away from Albuquerque. And when he went to move the blanket, he learned it was a tarp stained with blood. And initially, he wasn't all that alarmed since, you know, there's lots of elk and deer hunting in this region, and so it's probably pretty common to find tarps coming off of trucks and whatnot out on the side of the highway. For just a few feet away, he found a small girl's top, shorts, and blood-stained underwear. Raymond realized that since it had rained the night before, the tarp had to have been placed there in the morning as it was dry. Raymond also located duct tape near the clothes that was folded into a figure eight to be used as handcuffs. Hairs on the duct tape would later test positive as Gurley Chew's. Then at noon, 40-year-old bicyclist named Stephen Knight Williamson found Gurley's wallet on Tramway Boulevard in Albuquerque. He kept the wallet in the car until he learned on the news that night that Gurley was missing.
So police began casing Gurley's apartment. For one, the bleach stains had this reddish-brown tint to them. However, they couldn't collect those spots for DNA. The small blood spot was cut out from the carpet and brought in for forensics.
I believe they did do luminol testing too.
Yeah.
So they were able to, you know, find additional blood spatter to cut samples of.
Mm-hmm. And they also discovered several cat hairs in addition to natural and dyed deer hairs. And Gurley had no cats, and deer hairs, which I didn't know this, are actually used in fly fishing. But police were able to locate Linda Henning only 3 days after Gurley went missing. And at first, they were worried that she was in danger since she had been close to Dyson in the weeks leading up to Gurley's disappearance. And while she cooperated in the first interview, she stopped going to work and returning their calls, which cast suspicion on her.
Did you wash your breakfast off?
Last time I washed it, I still off. I'll try to keep the clothes clean.
I think that was last time you found it.
Let's see, I finally need the camera. Sorry.
She gives a good interview with the police. Seems very forthcoming. Doesn't seem nervous or upset. Very chatty. But police aren't so sure of her story.
How often did he talk to his wife? And when he did talk to her, how did he talk to him?
He said, well, they lived separate lives. He said they lived as man and wife for about 30 days in this bedroom.
How would you react if I told you that the last month he spent together with his wife?
I shouldn't have been before. So, and I've never heard these thoughts very heavy. So, he never made his voice. He always a gentleman.
Notice, I wouldn't believe it.
Notice how she's looking away from the detective. She's looking off to the side. Not sketchy at all.
And trying to just sound so unbothered and, you know, of course it's, Saturday? Just recently, like,
well, and
it's so obvious.
Convenient that that Saturday would have been the day after, you know, Gurley disappeared.
Yeah.
And she's like, no, just casually.
I just do it all the time. I love a clean car.
I love cleaning my car.
Sure, Linda. Okay.
Brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy. Just drop in some details about yourself and see if you're eligible to save money when you bundle your home and auto policies. The process only takes minutes, and it could mean hundreds more in your pocket. Visit Progressive.com after this episode to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio.
So when Bill Miller was taken in for questioning, he appeared normal for a while. That was until police left him alone in the interrogation room, and he tried to eat a business card for a local psychic. I think that's the first time I've heard of that, right, in the interrogation room. I'm sure it's happened many times. But.
It's so awesome. It's like, also, it's funny. It's like when I found out, because at first, it's like in the documentaries, they say like he just ate evidence. Mm-hmm. But then you find out it was for a local psychic. Like, why did he think that was going to matter?
I know. I was curious about that, too. What was, maybe there's something we don't know or something he hid.
What I think is a possibility is that maybe he went to the psychic after everything went down to see, like, okay, how good is she? If anyone were to actually ask her about it, like, you know, how close would she have gotten to what actually happened to Gurley?
Or maybe he revealed things to the psychic that if they went and talked to her.
Right.
That makes more sense.
Or maybe because they're fucking crazy, he thought that by eating the card, he'd have a direct link to the psychic.
Ooh, that's a theory, Tom.
I like that theory.
Yeah,
I like
he's
that.
Like, I'm channeling into her brain, eating the card. Anyway, so he is a dumb fuck, and he was arrested and charged with destruction of evidence while they looked for a connection to his role in Gurley's disappearance. However, the question still remained, where the fuck is Dyson? So on the day of Gurley's disappearance, a woman flew in from South Carolina, and she was engaged to Dyson Hossenkoft, and they went back to live together in her home. Then the police received a call from a neighbor who had seen Dyson the night before Gurley was reported missing. She said that Dyson had made a threatening phone call to her. However, that gave police his current phone number, and investigators could easily track Dyson's location to a neighborhood in South Carolina. And police arrested him on September 22nd, 1999, and he was charged with making threatening phone calls across state lines while a grand jury was convened to determine Bill and Linda's role in the disappearance. And during the grand jury, Linda explicitly stated that she had never met Gurley, even though prosecutors knew that she had seen Gurley at her place of work to open an account. So Linda was arrested at a nearby hotel on October 29th, 1999, and charged with perjury. And then during a subsequent search warrant executed on Linda's home, they discovered the ninja sword Dyson had purchased on September 9th, hidden inside the walls of her garage. And we're not completely sure on that. Some sources do say the attic. Pretty sure it's the garage walls.
That's according. That's according to Mark Horner. So the journalist who was covering this most closely at the time.
Yeah, I think he would know best for sure. And they also found that Linda owned six cats, which I do love cats, but six, that is a lot of cats. But anyway, the blade of the sword had been cleaned, while the hilt still had a few tiny blood stains, which is so disturbing thinking about if they really used a sword. It's so sad because Girly, she just seemed like such, people loved her. She seemed so kind and like free-spirited and happy and just sweet. And thinking about what the end of her life was probably like is just, it's horrifying.
I mean, it's crazy that the only person who literally has a bad word about her is Dyson, the man who...
of course.
You know. And yeah, that should just go to show, like, the most evil guy in the world is the only person who disliked this really wonderful person.
Yeah. Yeah. She really seemed to be just heartbreaking. Then there was a significant break in the case, though. The bloodstains on the carpet in Girly's home tested positive as Linda's, as did the blood-stained underwear that was found in the tarp. And one of the hairs found in Girly's house wasn't cat or deer hair. It belonged to Dyson.
In January of 2002, in preparation for the trial, Dyson took a plea deal to avoid the death penalty. He was given a life sentence plus 60 years if he provided information to the prosecution, as well as revealing the location of Girly's body. However, Linda, who maintained her innocence, pleaded not guilty and retained lawyers paid for by her friend Steve Zachary. Linda was charged with first-degree murder, kidnapping, conspiracy to commit kidnapping, perjury, criminal solicitation, and tampering with evidence. The prosecution believed that Linda killed Girly for Dyson with the ninja sword. However, they were unable to link Bill Miller to the murder, even though Bill was a known fly fisherman. He was given 5 years probation for eating the business card, although that would eventually be cleared. The prosecution believed that during the struggle, Girly, who had been taking self-defense lessons, fought back for her life against Linda and caused her to bleed on the carpet. After that, Dyson went to the apartment to clean up the scene and eventually get rid of her body. The prosecution also had evidence that Linda may have eaten some of Girly's body for an alien ritual. However, they decided not to use this in court, which this came from a conversation that was overheard.
Yes, it ended up that it was not admissible. And so it also, like we were discussing before, part of the conversation was that that's why they're not going to find the body was because Linda ate it. But really, they couldn't find anything past this recorded phone conversation to prove that cannibalism took place.
And this could just be a complete fabricated story.
Exactly.
To try to maybe pin things on somebody or, make Linda the fall person, potentially.
Yeah. Although, I wouldn't be totally shocked.
No. I mean, nothing
I wouldn't shocks. Pass these people. Yeah, put sure. anything past these people. So the defense only had one way out, a testimony from Dyson, in which he stated that Linda was not involved. However, for over 90 minutes while on the stand, Dyson went on this tirade about how Girly deserved to die a, quote, painful death, and that she was, quote, like a frightened rabbit in a field. And we actually have some clips from the testimony. It is so disturbing, you guys. The way he speaks as if he's so proud of himself, too, is so disturbing. Like, he doesn't give a damn. He has no feelings.
Well, and it's so fucked up that it's like, he's supposed to be taking this stand. Like, yes, the defense called him to clear Linda, but he's really just using it as an excuse to be like, look how much of a fucking genius I am.
Exactly. Like, here's my moment of fame.
Right.
Literally. My moment to shine. Freak. All right. Take a look, guys.
Actually is an evil person. And I've never experienced that before. I hope I never have to again.
It was a flawless plan. I mean, actually, if it wasn't flawless, you would have solved the murder by now. 3 years down the line, you still don't know what happened.
He talked in a way, it was almost like some evil cartoon character.
When you decide you're going to commit murder, you decide that you're going to trade your life for theirs. I did that.
Part of it, I think, was an act.
Don't decide.
But he was also a pretty despicable human being.
the plan was that she would be murdered, that she would be abducted. Hopefully, she suffered the most excruciating pain known to mankind. Was what
part
I
part of that may have been an act, because they adjust whatever environment they're in and make you believe whatever you want them to believe. I think what he was doing there is trying to get Henning off and acting as evil as he could, although in ways you could tell it probably wasn't all that hard of an act for him, because he appeared to be a real evil person. He orchestrated this totally unnecessary killing of this woman because she didn't do what he wanted.
That she is dead, that she is killed, that she might be murdered, so what? I mean, who cares? I don't. To this day, I have no remorse, no pity, no sorrow. I wanted to make sure that her parents knew and cried over 1,000 years over an empty grave. That's what.
Yeah, just, I don't know if I've ever seen, well, probably have, but that is one of the most evil testimonies I've ever seen. Right. Someone just outright in court act that way and have zero remorse when her family is sitting right there.
Well, and especially since part of his plea deal is revealing the location of her body, because it is important to their religion that they have her body to bury it.
Exactly.
And he's straight up saying right there, like, I want them to suffer for 1,000 years over an empty grave. Like, so fucked up.
Dude, he deserves to. If anyone deserves to burn in hell for eternity, it is this fucking man. He is so evil. And as you probably notice, he is speaking in this ridiculous accent. He's speaking like a lunatic. And he's like slipping in and out of this accent as well. Like, it's not authentic to how he actually speaks. He's just like trying to act like how he described, like an evil. It reminds me of like Dexter's Laboratory or like the Mojo Monkey from Powerpuff Girls. I don't know. I'm going way back in my brain, but.
Well, he's half alien.
Yeah.
That's so there's
maybe
that.
That's why he, fuck. Yeah.
It's the reptilian inside of him or whatever fuck alien he thinks he is.
Yeah. Well, he wouldn't want to be a reptilian. Of course, he's one of the good ones.
Yeah.
Can't even follow this man's mind, but yeah, the whole testimony was 90 minutes. And he said that he returned to the scene with one of his many vials of blood to mix with Gurley's to confuse the evidence. However, mistakenly, he took one of the vials containing Linda's blood. Yeah, sure, dude, I'm sure that's how it happened. And in addition, he was useless for Linda's defense, as the blood stains they were testing were the untainted ones, not the ones smeared with bleach. And in an attempt to save the case, Linda's attorney tried to say that Dyson had planted the blood to try and frame his client. However, the damage had most certainly already been done. And thankfully, Linda was convicted of the murder of Gurley Chu Hassenkopf on October 25th, 2003. And while she was the first woman in New Mexico history to face the death penalty, she was later sentenced to over 70 years in jail for the crime. And her perjury charges were actually dropped in 2010. And here's Gurley's brother Eric describing Dyson after his testimony. So think about what he had just said, and then this is her brother's reaction.
He's just cruel. There's only one word to describe him. He's cruel. And he just don't have conscience at all. What he has done, and he don't feel any remorse towards or what his action to my sister, that's terrible.
Murder is something you have to have the fortitude to do. It isn't something that goes lightly. It's something that you have to have predator qualities about you. You have to be able to do it and then not be afraid you're going to get caught.
Brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy. Just drop in some details about yourself and see if you're eligible to save money when you bundle your home and auto policies. The process only takes minutes, and it could mean hundreds more in your pocket. Visit Progressive.com after this episode to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it, your neighbors know it, heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
I'm just so thankful that they were able to get the convictions. Mm. You know, it's relatively more difficult sometimes to get these types of convictions in a nobody case.
Oh yeah, very a lot more challenging.
Well, I think him testifying on on his in Linda's trial really helped kind of solidify things and just really. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it was pretty easy for the jury to see he was involved with this, but I don't think he helped at all in Linda's trial whatsoever.
No.
And so thankful that both of them got maximum penalty here. But on September 5th, 1999, Girlie Chu wrote a letter to her parents back in Malaysia. She told them she'd always be their little girl and would visit them soon. The letter wouldn't reach them until weeks after she disappeared. In Chinese Buddhism, a body is necessary for burial and memorial. Without Girlie's body, her family cut pieces from a lotus flower and burned them to ashes to symbolize the young woman. The jar was blessed and placed at Penang's Bohai Anglim Temple. And every year on All Souls' Day, family members join to pray for her soul. The jar of ashes is still there to this day. Daisen Hossenkoft is still in Wyoming State Penitentiary, and he never made good on his plea deal. In January 2020, he filed a 400-page suit for the state of New Mexico to fully vacate his sentence. So just throw it out. Citing investigative malpractice on part of the police. His lawyer asked for a 6-month extension, but it sounds like, I mean, as far as we look, you know, there's nothing ever happened with this. They're never going to let this psychopath out of prison.
No, God, hopefully not.
Thank God. But the unfortunate reality is that Girlie's body is still missing to this day. And
her family has to live with that, just not knowing what happened or where she is. And that's just...
And these two clearly know.
Yeah, of course.
Clearly know and could provide that information, but they're just pure evil.
It won't change anything for them. Why not? Just because they're evil. Yeah.
They're evil. My head is like...
I know.
It's just... There's so much to process here. These guys are insane. Insane.
Yeah, just... It's so sad. It's just like really like... I don't know. You get to... It's just... It's such an insane story with Daisen. Mm-hmm. Like his just method of scamming is... unlike anyone, at least I've ever looked into, I've seen. But just the fact that it led to something so gruesome.
Yeah.
And like the judge said, unnecessary. And yeah, Girlie was just like a really lovely person who, like, yeah, she was also scammed, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
She was two kinds of victims, three kinds of victims to his fucking various crimes. And I think that it's just a shame that like no one else like saw what he was doing except for Girlie and the people in her life.
Mm-hmm. And there's probably still so much that we don't know that he put her through, did to her.
Right.
And just thinking about what, you know, the years leading up to her death were like, and just the torture he put her through mentally and physically is so upsetting, not to mention Dimitri. And, you know, that must have been so painful for her, being so bonded to him, losing him in the process, and then for him as well, being taken away from her. And it's heartbreaking to hear how he would see pictures of her and clearly was missing her even at such a young age. And I mean, he had so many victims, and thankfully he's locked up. But the fact that her family gets really no peace other than the fact that he is locked up, but no answers, no... I mean, anything, just how, I don't know how they move on. It's mind-blowing to me. It's so sad.
Yeah. And he would have absolutely kept us going.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And he may have ended up murdering others as well.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Time went on. You know, mm-hmm. It seemed like once people started figuring out what he was actually doing and what he was up to, he was willing to go to whatever lengths necessary to protect himself.
And with all the times where he was traveling and no one knew where he was, who knows what he was up to? He could have, I don't know, could have done even more gruesome shit. I don't know. Just such an evil. It's so scary to think that people like this that have, in my opinion, are just like soulless, just walk amongst us. You never know when you're going to come across someone like this.
Yeah, and
scary
it's,
world.
it doesn't really surprise me that this happened in the alien conspiracy realm.
Yeah, no. I mean, we see a lot of this.
Because, you know, as somebody who dove pretty deep into that world at one point, you can definitely start losing your mind a little bit. And if you start losing it to the point that you're now believing that you're a 400-year-old alien, and you start especially believing, you know, some of these really whack conspiracies that are out there, you know, about the elite being reptilians and things like that, and you start getting too deep into that to the point that it's completely changed your reality. Like for Linda, it seems like she genuinely believed that this was going on, that there are these evil aliens out there, and she needs to, you know, prepare for the end of the world that's coming. And she got so deep in it that she brought herself to this vulnerable state where she could be easily manipulated by somebody like Dyson, and was willing to do whatever it took, you know, to whatever he wanted, really, at the end of the day, just whatever he wanted. And because they really believe the shit that they're out there spewing. And I think my analysis is that if you go all the way back to the beginning with Dyson or Armando, he's just a con man. He's just a fucking con man at his core.
Yeah.
And that started way, way back then in the beginning of his life. And maybe that, you know, that brain injury or that, you know, traumatic injury head from injury, sports or something.
We don't know if it was a TBI.
Yeah.
It sounds like from what his family's describing, that's what they
I mean,
think.
He could have just had a concussion or something. It may not have been that serious, but
that's when they saw this massive shift in him.
But yeah, it's possible that that could be part of it as well. But
that's crazy to think about too. Like if that didn't happen to him, would any of this have happened? Like the butterfly effect.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I mean, he could have just been born evil and it made it worse, or didn't do anything at all. Yeah. He was always going to be this person. Yeah.
I think to your point, Josh, like I think what happened was, again, he was a perfectly average dude, perfectly average student, perfectly average everything. The brain injury, I mean, potential brain injury, the head injury that he sustained probably did fuck him up pretty good. But I think ultimately, like, he learned, oh, I can kind of get through all this stuff. I don't actually need to apply to med school. I don't actually need to do any of this stuff. I just have to lie to people enough. And I just have to lie enough.
Get good at lying.
To get good at lying and to get at least one person to believe me.
Yeah.
And I think that he just learned, like, that's actually how you do it.
Mm-hmm. Works once and he just keeps it going.
Right.
Yeah. And he's determined, especially it seems like he's so determined to prove himself as this extremely intelligent being when people around him are like, dude was average. He's actually not that smart at all. Yeah.
Well, when he's selective about who his victims are, and he's he's creating the pool for his, you know, his crimes, it's boosting his ego and giving him this false sense of security, because he continues to get away with it over and over and over again. And I think he just got,
I'm invincible.
He got so confident. Because even on the stand, I mean, he's clearly like, oh, I'm still smarter than all of you, because you guys haven't figured out what even happened.
Yeah,
don't
I don't
even
know if
the truth about what happened.
Did we play that clip?
Yeah,
I'm not
did.
Sure of him saying that you guys haven't figured it out by now.
Yeah,
yeah.
We did.
Okay, sorry. I couldn't remember if we had played that one, but that blew my mind.
Yeah, I mean, whenever perpetrators say something like this, I'm like, you just think you're smarter than everybody and, you know, you're proud of yourself and you like to be this evil villain. That you've painted yourself as and who you've become, that's really what it's all about. It's just, he's an egotistical fucking psychopath that doesn't care about anybody, Linda included. He only cares about himself. And he clearly didn't care about Girly whatsoever.
No.
He was just using people.
Yeah.
To, in his mind, take the easy route. He's like, I'll just fool all these suckers and, Get what I want in the end.
Yeah.
If you look at patterns with other con men and women, I mean, it's the same thing you see over and over again. The more they do it, the more confident they become in it.
Yeah.
But the more confident they become, then
start fucking up.
The mistakes come.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, just based on the way the scene was cleaned up, he thought he had everything covered. All the forensics were all covered up, and
sure,
he thought through everything. And to an extent, he did. but
somewhat.
He's not this super intelligent alien being that he really thinks he is, and no, he's really
dude's
just
an
a
idiot,
piece of shit,
grifter.
Yeah, grifter. So
it's not exactly difficult to dispose of a body in rural New Mexico.
Yeah, that like, is true.
The amount of like unmapped land out there, and the amount of like predation.
It's not like this.
It's
super,
not a high indicator. Of
super genius plan of
no,
this. Yeah,
no, it's yeah, fairly easy.
Yeah. Yeah, he's I'm glad he's in prison, and I hope it's a horrible place for him.
Mm-hmm.
Can't imagine walking around saying I'm a 400-year-old alien goes over well in the federal penitentiary, but
I don't know. I could see him like conning people there too, yeah, and like getting people to believe him.
He's making serums in prison.
At the end of the day, whatever situation he's in, whatever his life is like now is nowhere near the pain and suffering I know Gurley went through, and like and part of me wants to be like, I really hope that whatever happened, it was quick and as painless as possible. But I know it had to have.
Well, I mean,
horrible.
Based on the evidence, there was a physical fight. You know, that was
well, and what he
and,
said. I want. Yeah, hopefully, she right. experienced the most pain humanly possible. Whatever dumb shit he said, it's just God. Thinking about the end of her life is just so devastating. Yeah, poor Dimitri too. And yeah, we didn't, there's like information out there about him. We don't want to put out anything mm-hmm. about his, you know, current life, or but from what we know, he's alive. And yeah, that's all we'll share. But many victims.
Yeah,
just
a rough
horrible one.
Rough
yeah,
one.
Definitely. We want to hear what you all think. I'm sure you have a lot of thoughts, so let us know and we will catch you next week. But until then, keep on taking your mind a mile higher.
When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio.
Chances are you've been to the doctor recently, and you probably handed over your insurance, your ID, and even your Social Security number. Your doctor is just one of many places that has your personal info. And if any of them accidentally expose your details, you could be at risk for identity theft. LifeLock monitors millions of data points a second. If you become a victim, they'll fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART, or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.